introduce Patrick Gill with great pleasure. I've been reading Patrick for decades, I think. Decades.
1986.
I reviewed his first novel, his second novel, and his third novel, I seem to remember. Patrick was born in 1962 in the Isle of Wight. His father was the governor of Camp Hill Prison and later Wandsworth Prison. Very musical family, and Patrick at seven was found to have a very talented at singing, and he went to Winchester where he was a chorister. I just found out how to pronounce that word. And went on through Winchester and on to Oxford. And by the time he was 28, you had seven novels?
Something like that.
Seven novels to your credit by then. And 11 novels?
I think it's ten.
Ten?
A novella.
Okay. His best-known recent book is Rough Music. He's also written a biography of Armistead Maupin. And he's here this evening to read from his new book, A Sweet Obscurity. He's been praised, he's had almost every virtue ascribed to him by critics. He's been called elegant, mesmerizing, witty, bizarre imagination. I've always longed for people to call my imagination bizarre. I think that's the best compliment you could ever have. One critic said that he was like Iris Murdoch with pep pills. I think what I would say, what I enjoy most, I have tremendous pleasure from reading his novels. They're very humane. They're very, very amusing and very elegant in their structure. But I really like sitting down and reading them. I take great comfort. And so I'm really looking forward to hearing the real thing. Read every word.
Does this work? I don't know. I've already been warned by the long-suffering marketing department at HarperCollins that my new novel, A Sweet Obscurity, is, as they said, a pigged pracy. So I'm not even going to try to pracy it to start with, because it has quite a complex structure. I thought what I'd do instead is read you four short extracts, each of them introducing one of the four principal adult characters. And then Maureen and I can pull it all to pieces and talk about structure and interesting things like that. There are two men and two women, Eliza, Julia, Pierce, and Giles. Eliza is Giles's estranged wife, Julia is Giles's mistress, and Pierce is a man that none of them have met yet. When the novel begins, poor Eliza has really lost her way in life and is probably suffering from clinical depression, although she doesn't realize that. She's living in a council flat with her estranged husband's elderly dog, who dies on the first page. And in this extract, she has just dumped the dog on the mistress because the mistress has a garden and somewhere to bury it. Eliza walked home in a daze, fell back into bed, and cried herself to sleep. Initially, she wept because she was so tired and because Carlo's long illness was over. But the deeper reason was one she could barely have spelled out, even to herself. Carlo was not her dog, not strictly. Strictly speaking, he belonged to Giles. But he had bought him on a whim, had never loved him as he ought, and had found less and less time in which to give him walks. He had also acquired a mistress with a fur allergy, but hid this motive behind the characteristically barbed pronouncement that a dog had no place in a childless house. There remained the small matter of their legal bond, but Carlo had been the last palpable vestige of a marriage gone awry, and now she was finally cut adrift. Eliza spent Sunday in bed, stirring only to brew cups of tea, slap the used tea bags into the sink, and smear margarine onto bread before retreating with this meagre nourishment to her room. Her room smelt neglected, but she could not care. Occasionally a draught through one of the cracked windows brought worse smells under the door from the dog's deathbed. The telephone was silent, disconnected when she failed to keep up payments against the last bill. She had read once that sleepiness was a symptom of depression, that the depressed sought negation of their pain in slumber. If this was true, she had been suffering from depression all her life. Even as a small child, she had faced the bossy arrival of daylight with a kind of horror, and retired each night with relief. Dressed or naked, asleep or watchful, To be curled within or sprawled upon a bed was her natural state, from which every other activity was a resented departure. She was a born nester, whose animal affinities had always lain with sloths, lemurs, and dormice, rather than with nature's predatory adventurers. Alone, shoeless, and horizontal, she felt more truly herself than when she was upright and out in the world. Unless she could guarantee a deep and dreamless sleep, however, taking to her bed was hardly a depressive's escape, since once there, she had nothing to distract her from the steady contemplation of herself. Sorry, I must grab some water. Now for someone completely different. This little passage introduces Julia. No, it doesn't. This little passage introduces Giles, the ex-husband and Julia's lover. Giles is extremely good-looking, not quite young anymore, an opera singer who's not quite in the first league. And he's one saving grace, really, is that he's devoted to Dido, the child, the niece, who Eliza has been raising as her own daughter. And this little extract comes from the chapter where we first meet Giles, when he's spending a long weekend, well, actually quite a short weekend, with his alcoholic mother and her husband. Weekends with his mother and stepfather were fragile affairs, painstaking constructions of good manners and enthusiasm forever tearing at their papery edges. By weekend at home, most sons would mean two or even three nights. For Giles, that would have proved unsustainable. His practice was to arrive at tea time on Saturday, then leave precisely 24 hours later. His mother always baked a cake, slices of which framed the visit like sticky bookends. He often had performances or concerts to sing on Saturday nights, so visits like this were not a regular thing. Neither side could have borne them if they were. But he felt they were good for Dido, as she saw so little of her maternal grandmother and had so little family life. He worried she was being dragged down and limited by Eliza's straitened style of living, and he was not above entertaining wicked fantasies in which, through timely interventions of justice or death, he became sole parent. On the weekends when Dido was with him, he tried to fill her time with things he felt it might lack when she was with her mother. Beauty, sophistication, above all, a sense of possibilities, a sense of all the places she might go and all the things she might become. In the event, she often simply watched television or spent an evening in one of the opera houses before he took her out to dinner. She did not like music much, not real music, but she enjoyed the opera because of the costumes and drama and in spite of any sounds the singers made. This had taken time. When she first saw the magic flute in a fluffy, witty production, which he had thought the ideal introduction, she kept covering her ears and complained of the singers afterwards. It's as if they're putting their insides outside. They're showing too much. Showing too much was something Giles keenly understood and feared in himself. His father died when he was 8, which sent his mother spiraling into lost years of alcoholism. Boarding school was a kind of prison for other boys. For him, it brought release from a mother's incoherent moods and unwanted confidences, a place of orderly restraint as respite from a damaging lack of boundaries. She saw the light only when, old enough at 17 to stand up to her, he flatly refused to come home one summer holiday and instead spent 2 months visiting friends and working on farms. At the end of the summer, realizing he had survived and would survive without her dubious protection, he wrote a short, brutal letter, telling her so and telling her why. In an effort to make her just another adult, he addressed the letter to Dear Trudy rather than Dear Mum, and had called her nothing else since. Stung, she took herself off to the local chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous, where she began carefully to rebuild herself and where she met Ron. He was an insurance salesman, the kind of man she had raised Giles to ignore, but he worshipped her in his bluff way and seemed content never to find out who she really was. They shared a life of unimpeachable normality in a household shorn of stimulants, took bird-watching holidays, played golf, and continued to attend AA together as other couples attended church. Oddly, she was no longer contrite, as she had frequently been when drunk. Instead, sobriety made her honest. "Oh, no," she blurted out once, "I'm not happy. You can't be happy when you're always being careful, but I'm calm and I've stopped being frightened all the time." Built over an abyss, her life with Ron was a neatly hedged hell, but looked happy and ordinary enough in 24-hour doses. There was a lunch of roast chicken and a trifle unredeemed by sherry, then a short walk with binoculars and bird books before yesterday's cake made a second appearance and set Giles free. Now you can meet Julia. Julia had grown up in an atmosphere of physical and legal disorder among undisciplined people, so had naturally developed an instinct that control was all important. If a bill was paid on receipt, there would be no shaming final demand. If food was eaten carefully, there would be no stains. If one thought a sentence through before beginning to speak it, there was less risk of ill effect. If a room was kept tidy, if everything was returned to its proper place after use, if no unpleasant task was ever deferred, life became less nebulous, its unavoidable problems uncluttered by needless ones. She had never understood girls who complained that their mothers were always on at them to tidy their rooms, since her room had always been the only tidy one in the house. Small, still refuge of neatly labelled shoeboxes and underfilled orderly drawers. Now that most households had nobody keeping house full-time, a new career had arisen which would have suited her perfectly. She could have been a clutter counsellor, paid to show people how to remove every possession from a room, put only one-fifth of them back, and survive the trauma. Julia knew better than to say so aloud, but she intuitively understood the appeal of little clips to keep socks in pairs through the wash, of drawer dividers to keep bras and knickers untangled, of electronic diaries that reminded one when to post a birthday card. She was swiftly smitten with Giles because he was beautiful, the first truly beautiful man she had known, and because he needed her. But she only became emotionally involved when she recognized him as a fellow refugee from disorder, damaged first by his appalling mother and then by Eliza. The moment Dido first appeared, in tights with holes in them and without a sensible coat, the child similarly awakened in her a desire to rescue her from an unregulated life. This was odd because, if questioned closely, she would have admitted to being godless and selfish, still enough the refugee for her principal instinct to be self-preservation rather than the succoring of others. When she thought about them, however, the anomalies pleased her, as small but significant proofs that she had a heart. Now the fourth man in the equation is, the second man, is Pierce, who is a Cornish farmer. Pierce is an orphan. He has a sister, and the sister's marriage has fallen apart. So he is rather relied on to be a childminder, which he's doing in the first chapter when we meet him. He's also recently discovered the delights of the internet. There were as many chat rooms as there were topics for discussion, but it was amazing how many of the tapped-in conversations soon came down to sex. He had been to sites connected with farming, with history, with Cornwall, even with suicide, and in all of them, sooner or later, established that a person he was talking to was a woman and horny. There was a limit to what could be done with words, but it was still wilder than mere pictures, and he came away sensing he'd been given a glimpse of someone's deeper wishes. He had been left feeling not quite so alone. After a while, he had given up pretending and headed straight for a chat room about love, in other words, sex. It was called, with breathtaking originality, lonesometonight.co.uk. You gave yourself a name when you logged on, and Pierce enjoyed being different people. John, the fireman with a big hose. Peter, the carpenter with a woody. Judd the butcher, who liked the feel of flesh beneath his hands, and so on. He had become a very fast two-finger typist. Sorry, too much Sensodyne toothpaste. He had soon guessed that he was not the only one, being someone he wasn't. Subtracting years, adding inches, changing job, name, hair colour, with a few blithe keystrokes. Few of the women could be the curvaceous, tanned, devil-may-care temptresses they said they were, or they'd have had too much of a social life to be spending an evening in with a computer. Some would be plain. Some would be married. Some might be old enough to be his mother. Some might be scared of meeting people in the flesh. Some might not even be women. It did not matter. They would never meet, and their words and fantasies combined to flatter and fulfill each other. Then one day, a woman he had been chatting to, who had described herself as a size 8 and billed herself as Tina, a voracious 20-something brunette who liked two-on-ones and having her insteps licked by a man with a day's growth of beard and hands with engine grime around the nails, broke through the glass barrier between them. Breaking all the unwritten rules, she had stopped halfway through telling him how she'd like it if he'd handle her just after stripping a truck engine and left grimy fingerprints all over her full but still pert breasts. Suddenly, she typed, "Oh, sod it. My name's Janet, I'm a size 12 and a mother of 3 under 8s. I'm 38, bored as fuck and living in Hale." He had been so startled, he typed back that he was Pierce, not a black mechanic from Detroit, but a white farmer from West Penwith and just turned 40. She had asked him where he went to school, and they had established that her clever younger brother had gone to Humphrey Davy too, but only after it stopped being a grammar school. A cousin of his had taught RE at her school, a distant cousin. He had asked about her children. She had asked about his farm. He had found himself telling her about his dead parents, about Molly's marriage, and how her husband had been ruined by buying too many pigs and getting into debt during the BSE crisis, about how he loved children, how he was babysitting his niece as they typed. "What about you?" he had typed. "What do you like doing?" "TV," she had said. "Lots of TV," which depressed him until he remembered she had small children. "And I go dancing at the barn when I get the chance, which is about once a year, but it makes me feel ancient until I've had a few." 38's a very sexy age," he had typed back daringly. "You know a thing or two. You know what you want." "Yeah," she had responded. "That's easy for a 40-year-old to say. Sorry, gotta go. See you." He had told her too much and scared her off. And she had regretted being so open and had grown inhibited. He had logged onto the site punctiliously for the last 10 days or so, looking for Tina Threeway among the usual suspects, but she was never there. Either she had changed her moniker, or she had given up and switched to a different chat room entirely, regretting her honesty. Try as he might, he suddenly found he could muster no interest in anyone else, in Lulu or Sabina or Grease Monkey or Hot Lips, and their predictable come-ons soon turned to surly defensiveness when he failed to respond. For all that they were sparing themselves, hiding behind false names and artificial language, the chat room now felt as bleak and humiliating as any singles night in a half-empty bar. Lonesome tonight, indeed. When he logged on this evening, he meant only to check his emails. But one of these was from Billy Pender, with a query about the next day's cattle auction and how many lots Pierce was interested in. To answer it, he had to stay online a little longer to visit the auctioneer's website and online catalogue. He noted down the lot numbers, emailed Billy back the response, then lingered just a little too long and found himself tapping in www.lonesometonight.co.uk. She was there. "Janet," he typed. He guessed that by using her real name, he could gauge immediately how she felt now about their early honesty. There was a pause. She had forgotten his name. Of course she had. "Pierce," she typed. "How are you?" "Fine. How are you, Janet?" "Never better. Hot, wet. What are you wearing?" He paused. So that was how it was going to be. "Just got in from the garage," he typed. "Oily overalls, nothing much underneath. Buttons or zip?" "Buttons. Rubber buttons, most of them missing. You?" "Black negligee. Red lace knickers. Bra? No, too hot. That feels good. Cut me from behind. Are your hands dirty?" "Filthy. I'm leaving fingerprints all over you and I don't care." "Janet?" "What? What are you doing now?" "Giving you my phone number," he typed, and logging off. "I hate this." course.
Cliffhangers. I wanted to ask you about structure, because as I said, the structure of this novel and all your other novels is very, very elegant. You have several stories that start in different places and then come together. And where do you get them from?
Well, I mean, my working practice is effectively to write mini novels, one for each character, to ensure that they have a complete story. And then I have this nightmarish period of being a bit like someone working on a soap opera, and I have to juggle these post-it notes around to weave the stories in a way that won't give away things or will tell things from the best angle. But in this case, it really got a bit extreme, because the starting point for this was the Elizabethan madrigal. I had this incredibly vivid dream. I'd been singing madrigals with a rather terrible local group in Cornwall, and I'd obviously eaten too much Stilton or something, and I had this amazing dream where I heard in the dream this lost madrigal. It didn't exist, but in the dream it was a lost one that someone had found. And I woke up remembering that the melody went, but I remembered the words, great chunks of the words. And I had, the way you do in a dream, a sort of instant understanding of the story of the man who'd written it. And it was the dead of night, and the way you do in the dead of night, I had a mad idea, and I thought, oh, well, I'm going to change direction and write an historical romance, and that'll pay for a new kitchen and all of a sudden. Luckily, by breakfast, I'd seen the light and saw that was a stupid idea, but that I could use this backstory, if you like, this germ about the Elizabethan madrigalist and the lost madrigal as a starting point for the book. And then when I started researching madrigals a bit more, because Eliza, the first character, is a musicologist specialising in them, I discovered something I'd never found before, which was that when they were published back in Elizabethan times, they weren't printed as a whole the way they are now. If you buy the Oxford Book of Madrigals now and you open it, you see all the vocal parts at once. You can see what everyone else is doing. But in Queen Elizabeth's day, you've got several separate books, one for each voice. So you'd have your own part. Okay. You'd have no idea what the other singers were singing. And they must have been very good singers, because there were no cues often, nothing. Just empty bars and then your bit. And so it was only when the four or five or six of you sat around a table with your books and began to sing that the song would take shape. And so what I tried to do here was to mimic that by having these separate books in which each of the adults has no idea really what's going on with the other adults' lives. Even though they see each other regularly, they all have secrets, they all misinterpret one another. And the madrigal, if you like, that they weave ends up being very much about the child in their midst, who Dido, who doesn't get any chapters to herself. She's interpreted by the adults, who will need her for their own purposes. Mm. And gradually you build up this picture of this poor girl who really, in some ways, is suffering a kind of middle-class abuse by some ways, yeah.
But I'm sure that your understanding of voice is different than other authors because of this background that you have in music. And when you say that you're not giving the main character a voice, that's a really terrible thing to do, isn't it?
It is, in a way. I mean, my previous novel, Rough Music, had, for the first time, I gave a child major focus in the book, and he had chapters written from his viewpoint. And I felt easy enough doing that because he was so closely based on me as a seven-year-old, so I knew roughly what he'd be thinking. Whereas I never was a nine-year-old girl, and I was a bit wary of getting inside her head in case it was mawkish. But also, I wanted her to be suppressed. I was interested in the effect that would have on the energy of the book. Mm-hmm. And I think it pays off, because in most of my books there's a character who doesn't get a voice, who then provides a sort of anger in the last third of the book. And in Rough Music, it was the sister who is sort of misinterpreted as much by the reader as by the other characters until the last third of the book, where she suddenly, suddenly realise what you've been reading is sort of her revenge tragedy, in which she pulls the whole structure apart. And in this book, the child does much the same.
She's a very strong character.
Which?
Dido.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, some reviewers have said she's a bit unnatural in that she's quite eloquent. But in my experience of children from extended families, from what used to be called broken homes, they do become eloquent at a much earlier age, especially when it comes to discussing quite adult emotions and problems, because they become a party to all sorts of scenes they wouldn't otherwise have witnessed.
Did you... your stories are separate, but they do intertwine. Mm. People turn up, and they're not four people living their own lives and never seeing each other. I mean, three of them are very, very linked at the very from the very beginning. Yeah. So, how do you write them all at the same time?
I write them consecutively. So I wrote all of Eliza's story from beginning to end, and then I wrote all of Giles's. And what's quite fun doing that way is that the characters start rebelling a bit, at least the last three do, because you suddenly realise that they're not going to behave the way you thought they would, and the plot changes as you're writing it. Because
and then you have to go back to the beginning.
Yes, and then redo the first character, usually.
Cut her down to size.
Yeah. I mean, and I'd originally planned Giles as my first truly evil character. I'd spent a whole year kind of doing, chatting about rough music, when people said, oh, what are you working on now? And I said, oh, I'm finally doing my sort of attempt at the Patricia Highsmith thing, and have this completely amoral, destructive, really quite dangerous person. And of course, I'm far too soft, and he ended up being really quite, not lovable, but not at all the man I planned. I think that's to do with rounding characters off. I think the longer my books have got, the more in depth the characterizations have become, and it's become far harder to dismiss the characters. In my early books, I think I was often really unfair on them, especially on some of the women.
But if you were
because
going
I didn't go in deep enough, and it was much easier to be flip about them. Whereas if you give them all that space, it's very hard not to start sympathizing for them.
And also, if you're, as you said before we came in here, you spend a lot of time working on the land, yeah?
I do now.
And so you don't, while you're working, you have more time to think about characters, and they get more complicated, too complicated for
I
a plot,
so.
Don't they?
Yes, and long walks with the dog as well. You find yourself thinking through the characters rather as if they were difficult relatives who'd come to stay, and you had to think through their problems before you get back to the house and know how to deal with them.
If you were going to look at your early novels now and put them next to your more recent novels, what do you think has changed, aside from what you've just said,
which
aside is the,
from the, length
the depth
and
of the characters? Yeah.
They've got much darker, I think. I mean, the early novels hinted of darkness, but perhaps because they were shorter, they tended to be quite happy-go-lucky, quite farcical. And I think arguably, as I've become happier, and therefore I've now gained the emotional strength to confront the dark stuff.
To have read unhappy books.
Yes, I think so. I think as we sort of wear opposite ends of the jigsaw, not the jigsaw, the seesaw.
Yeah. But your plots are also, they're very carefully constructed. There are secrets, there are chance encounters, very much like certain operas I remember quite well. Yeah. And is that, do you plan all that as well, or is that just the...
I plan quite a lot of it. Often, some of it's just shameless mechanics. You need a secret in order to propel the plot, sometimes. I rely much too heavily on that. I'm determined the next book is going to have no secrets at all and no sisters. I've overdone both those in the last two books. But I plan quite a lot of it. I tend to walk around with a new book coming up in my head as a sort of neurosis for about 6 months before I write anything.
Uh-huh.
And then I start trying to map out plot, but that tends to be fragmentary, and I take a leaf out of George Eliot's book as well. I compile a sort of quarry, what he called a quarry, on each of my characters, rather as if I was an actor about to play them, so I have to know their backstory and all sorts of details about them that probably don't end up in the book.
Do you ever go back to those notebooks? I keep notebooks like that, and then I never ever reread them. I mean, I have to write everything down. But
gosh, no, I write longhand now. I do my first draft of every book longhand, which is terribly risky, I know, but it means I can work out of doors, and I live in this idyllic spot, and it's so wonderful just being able to take a novel out to a field above the sea and work out of doors, which you can't do with a laptop because you cannot see the screen when the sun is shining. So,
You wrote this... when did you write the biography of Armistead?
Oh, Lord. That was before Rough Music, I think. Was it? Yes.
And what... I mean, because there is something... It's not... his way of writing is very different from yours. He wrote a lot sort of week by week, didn't he?
Yeah.
But there's something in the mood or the attitude or the sort of vision of life or whatever that's similar.
We're very on the same wavelength. I think it's in our attitude to what fiction should do, which is to do with extending sympathies.
Uh-huh.
I know when he and I talk about books we like, the books we both seem to go for tend to be novels which perhaps force you to spend a bit of time with people you wouldn't sit next door to on a bus, but you end up really loving them. It's a bit sort of cheesy and 60s, I suppose. I like the thought that as well as entertaining somebody, a novel can actually change their way of thinking a bit. And I know that's something else that's changed my earlier books. In my earlier books, they were pretty crude about the sexual politics. And I now try to mask that in enough plot that it doesn't seem
The sexuality and sex lives of the characters it's quite a range, yeah.
Yeah.
And
well, again, like Armistead, it's not. We both have a horror of being put in a ghetto.
Yeah.
Certainly, as a gay man, I never really was any good at the ghetto thing. I hate nightclubs. I hate smoke. and I like conversation, which you don't get much of in a noisy bar. So. And Armistead says much the same thing, and so I think we both of us ended up creating our social lives in the fiction rather, and going for this much broader sort of rainbow spectrum of personalities and proclivities.
Going to Armistead Maupin's way of writing, I don't know how many of you have read him, but Tales of the City, he didn't actually write week by week for a newspaper, did he?
The first three volumes, yes.
Yeah, and what do you think is possible if you're writing that way, that isn't possible if you have more time to plan and change and
all sorts of things. I mean, for a start, it can be incredibly topical, the way his work. Mm. I mean, so you could, if there was an earthquake on Monday, you can have it in Thursday's episode, which you obviously can't do with a novel.
And survive.
And you can change your mind as well. If you're writing it week by week, you can kill off a character you planned on keeping alive for ages. You can.
Well, I lived in San Francisco the years that he was writing that, and when I went back to reread the books, all the things that I had edited out of my memory because they were too embarrassing were all in the books.
Oh,
you know, all of our expressions, all of the
pet rocks.
No, I didn't have a pet rock.
And of course, they were the first books to be generated by fax as well, because people in San Francisco would clip them and then would fax them to friends on the other side of the states or whatever. So, yeah.
You also mentioned Iris Murdoch was one of your
very strong
mentors.
Influence. Yes. I think that she's another one with if we're talking about a wide range of sympathies and types of love, particularly love. I mean, she, broadly speaking, all my novels are love stories, rather the way hers are, but in the broader sense, in that they're not necessarily about romance, but they're about people trying for different ways of loving. And like her, I think I use love in a very, I suppose theologians would call it a post-Christian way, in that it's almost a mystical, it's something very potent in the plots, and occasionally it's almost magical the way it will sort of change someone's life or turn the plot around.
But there are ways in which you're very different from, you've changed, moved on from her.
Yes, well, her plots are very mechanistic in a way. She's so interested in ideas, and I think she's very good at building up characters and situations. So the first third of her novels tends to be wonderfully kind of built up, and you have these wonderful scenes, a bit like an Ivy Compton Burnett, where you suddenly realise halfway through that the two characters who are talking are in bed together, and you haven't realised that at the beginning, and then you realise that they're both married to other people. I love that in her books, but then what tends to happen is she has this plot which is constructed to prove something, some philosophical idea, and that's where it goes wrong for me, in the last third of the books, where the characters should be rebelling against the plot. They aren't allowed to, and they feel a bit stifled.
And so you would say that one of the things that you enjoy about writing is that the plot, the plan gets disproved, that the characters remake it.
Yeah. If you have that wonderful moment when you suddenly realise that the psychology, all the psychological details you've built up for the characters is sufficiently lifelike for them to turn around to you, as it were, and say, this plot doesn't fit me anymore, I'm going to do that. And That's the moment where you realise the book is starting to breathe.
Well, another thing that's unusual, I mean, that you don't find in terribly many novels right now, that all of your characters are very much embedded in their work. They, you know, if the singer is going to recording, he has to warm his voice. Mm. You find out everything that he does. And the jobs actually make the characters just as much as everything.
Yeah. Well, right? I think I'm a job vampire.
Because
I've never had a grown-up job until now. Now I'm an unpaid cauliflower labourer. I feel like I can hold my head up to my parents and say, I grow food for a living. But until recently, all I've ever been is a writer, which always felt like a slightly kind of vampiric way to make a living. And whenever I met people who had interest or any kind of job that I hadn't heard of before, I catch myself finding out about it and sort of saying, and, you know, what do you do then, and how does this work, and I kind of hoard all these details. And I fear sometimes that spills over almost too much in the books. You get so much detail, you don't necessarily need it.
Oh, no, I think it's interesting.
But, I spend a lot of time with musicians, so this book is, I think, the most musical one I've done. Mm-hmm. Not just the Giles, the singer, but the musicologist and the musician's agent as well.
The bitchy agent, yes, yeah. Selena. Yeah. The dry Selena. But also, you're coming more and more to be seen as a Cornwall writer. Do you like, I mean, it's because there is a strong sense of, not that Cornwall is the only location, but when you get to Cornwall, you have a much stronger sense of place.
Yeah.
Do you like that or not?
I don't mind it. Yeah. I don't mind it. There's such a strong tradition in Cornwall, of writers using Cornwall. And I haven't yet got tired of playing with that. I mean, in Rough Music, I played with it in that it was, the Cornwall I was showing was very much the romantic holidaymaker's Cornwall. The Cornwall you tend to take in your head to the beach and you feed on the beach by reading Rebecca or something. So
Rough Music.
It's not entirely real. And in A Sweet Obscurity, in a way, what I've done is do a companion book to Rough Music in that it flips that on its head and forces you to confront the real Cornwall, where you BSE and rather ugly bits and mining and all the things that people tend not to notice when they're on holiday there. I don't know, and I in turn feeds into the madrigal theme, because one of the things madrigals used repeatedly was this clash between town and country, mm-hmm. and as well as the clash between men and women. And on the face of it, most Elizabethan madrigals are quite shallowly pastoral, nymphs and shepherds. But when you look closely at the words, they're often actually quite darkly passionate and erotic, and they're using the pastoral as a means of confronting darker stuff. And I think I do this, and I try to do that in this book. And so you have the three London characters who come down to the country, in one case against her will. And there they're made to confront all sorts of things about their erotic lives, which they hadn't dealt with in town.
I was wondering if any of you had questions. I can barely see you, but so wave your hand before I pick on somebody. Nobody? There must be somebody up there.
We should
question.
Have planted a question beforehand. I forgot. We'll have to think of something something suitably shocking to say that might get a hand.
No, we're not going to. They're. Hello. I really can barely see you anyway. I can see you laughing up there, so you must have. When I was in Cornwall a few days ago, everybody I met who heard that I was going to be speaking to you said they wanted to know if Rough Music was based in the house at the end, that end of Polzeth, or the other end?
The other end.
Well,
yes, I was quite lazy. I changed all the place names slightly in Rough Music, partly because I wanted it to be a sort of hyper Cornwall rather than real Cornwall. But no, the house most of the book is set in is a real bungalow on the beach at the far end
Baby
of Polzeth. Baby Bay, yes.
Baby Bay.
But the bungalow in real life isn't nearly as nice as the one in the book.
I looked at it very carefully.
I was tempted to push it through their letterbox. So here are some decorating tips. Get rid of that brown gloss paint.
Do you use, do you always use houses that you know?
Quite often.
And transplant them?
Yes, I think I do. And The Facts of Life was largely set in a real house called A La Ronde at Exmouth, but I transplanted the whole house to the Fens, but I took with it the real-life family history that went with it. And in this book, I unwittingly have ended up using buildings I know. I think a lot of writers, you often do it without realizing it. You just conjure up bedroom, and instantly it becomes a bedroom you know.
Well, I always use houses I know, but I cover my tracks. So I just hope that the owners don't recognize them when the house is in a new country.
You're rude about it. You're nasty smell.
Oh, yes, I'm always rude about it. Yes, yeah. Especially the bookshelves. You were also, we were talking before about the tyranny of marketing. Yeah?
Yeah.
Because you, in the beginning, you were quite heavily marketed, sort of aggressively marketed by 80s standards when you started out.
Kind of. I was always a very difficult author for publishers, though, because the books weren't easy to categorize. They couldn't market them as as just gay, because apart from the very first one, The Aerodynamics of Pork, they've always been so sort of mixed. And it was very clear from about book number three that my main readership was heterosexual women, so they didn't want to cut that or that market off. And then I kept doing slightly different books each time. So what publishers really want you to do is do more of the same.
Yeah.
Hit a winning formula and repeat it, which is death for most writers. So what they did instead was they kept trying to give me a look. They tried to brand me. So I kept getting these you know, uniform jackets, which were never quite right.
I remember them very well. The early ones were they looked like the seaside postcards, didn't
they? Yes, Beryl Cook did original paintings for the first two novels,
really?
Which was extraordinary because they had no budget. There was no marketing budget assigned to them. And I think somebody must have been friends with her or something, asked her to do them. And that was a nightmare because my publishers then couldn't afford to commission pictures from her. But they kept trying to find Beryl Cook pictures that would more or less fit the books, which gave quite the wrong impression, and it made them look as if they were sort of saucy or something, which they weren't. And then I had HarperCollins started branding me by, they commissioned a whole series of rather wonderful, completely surreal paintings, all inspired by the novels, which were completely confusing to anyone who hadn't actually read the book, so that didn't work. And then they read some market research which said that men respond to photographs. And they were desperate to get men to read my book, so they rejacketed them again with photographs. But the trouble is the photographs were all of objects, and my books were about people. So, you know, a book with a typewriter on or a pair of tap shoes didn't give much away. But finally, with Rough Music, they came up with a wonderful cover, a winning cover that actually had a person on it. And so they've now branded me yet again, this time with... Well, I said to them, let's put people on all the jackets, but yet again they've got it wrong and they put a bicycle on one of them, which is not a person. But still. And now we're going down market, you see. They've very scary what happens. They showed me a proof.
They show them the cover.
Yeah, they showed me a proof for the new cover, and I thought, lovely, little girl, perfect. She's even got bunches and untidy hair, like the little girl in the book. And it had what they call a shout line, which you probably can't read it. It says... Some things are more precious than you imagine. And I thought when I saw this proof that this was a proof for the poster at the bookshop. So I thought, great, they're going to spend some money on me. And it was only when I opened the parcel of advanced copies and I realised it was actually on the jacket, which is like saying, this is an airport book. Which is my other half has been teasing me mercilessly about this. In fact, it's become a sort of bedtime parlour game because Rough Music had a shout line which was... some things stay with you forever. And this one is, some things are more precious than you can imagine. So now we come up with things like, some things get right up your nose, or some things stick to the sole of your shoe. Anyway, so I hope we can get rid of that for the next edition with them.
And can you do anything about that?
I wasn't nearly, because I didn't realise it was for the jacket, I was completely unassertive. I'm not very good at throwing my weight around because they're all so nice at my publishers. They're terribly sweet to
me. Until you throw your weight around about the shout line.
Yeah, I think it's time I did, yes. We'll see how the sales figures are.
Maybe they could put that in a different language or something. Put it in Latin.
Or just put it on the back or something. It's something very naff, I think, about... It's odd. It's treating it like a film. I mean, films have these ridiculous shout lines.
Yes.
Novels don't need them. It's odd.
Are there any of you have a question? No. Yes.
Ah,
Georgina.
Right.
Okay.
I'm very fascinated. It's like that always the first thing that was said is you wrote a second novel by the time you were 28.
So I was an early starter.
I'm kind of interested at sort of what it felt like inside when you were sort of 21, 22, sort of taken off at such a rate.
I've never been in therapy. I think that's half of it. And my agent has forbidden me ever to go to a therapist because he's convinced it's all from neurosis, this desire to keep writing. And I must admit, he's probably right, because when I look at the novels as a group and at the repeated motifs in them, they look like a bit like a cry for help. but no, I think I was ridiculously lucky. I wrote my first novel when I was trying to be an actor. I should add that this person here saw me in Salad Days when I was a student, so she knows what a good thing it was that I didn't manage to become an actor. Yeah, well. My dancing was good. My dancing was good. I was trying to be an actor, so I wasn't thinking of myself as a novelist. I was writing the novel just for fun while working in a terrible restaurant where I had to sing as well as being a waiter, and no one came, probably because of the singing. And there were these long, long shifts from 6 at night until 6 in
was
the morning.
Was that in Oxford?
No, this was on Long Acre in Covent Garden.
Oh, gosh.
It was closed down because of a cocaine scandal. I think the whole thing was a drugs front, I think. They advertised in the stage and got all these would-be actors as sort of helpless pawns in this sort of drug thing, I think. Anyway, so I wrote the first novel just for fun, and a friend of mine who was also an aspiring actor had as her temp job, she was a typist for a literary agent, and she took the novel away ostensibly to read it herself, and then without telling me, showed it to her boss, and then he rang up and said, I think we could find you a publisher. And I suddenly thought, well, actually, I could be Dirk Bogarde, I could be an actor and a novelist. And, luckily, the novel contract came through first. But in some ways, I felt I served an apprenticeship in public. I mean, my first two or three novels, the ones Maureen so kindly reviewed, and she wasn't that kind, actually. She said he is skating on the surface of his talent, which is very kind of schoolmarmish, but quite right when I look back at them, because they were terribly lazy books. I was showing off the way, like a child who's suddenly given too much cider. And so in some ways, they shouldn't have been published, in a way. I think I should have had a few rejection slips and been made to try harder, but I didn't. So
I don't think so.
Well, I know some people have this amazing affection for them. When I look at them, I'm embarrassed because they seem terribly underwritten. And I didn't have a decent editor until Rough Music. That was the first time, with novel number 9, I had an editor who had enough of a budget assigned to me that she had enough time to work on the book properly. I mean, most editors are crazily overworked now, and they do little more than look for spelling mistakes. So
they don't do that.
Well, they try. The computer does that. At HarperCollins, the computer does that.
Well, she's a writer without doubt. Sometimes I thought.
And she refused to be edited to her dying day. They were all unedited, and it showed. I think. But, I love her novels, but they did get very baggy.
Are there any other questions up there?
Hello.
I remember you.
Rough Music was probably your most autobiographical book today. Was it a conscious effort then when you decided that this wasn't going to be based on it?
Which this novel? Well, it is very based on my experiences. But it's codified again, much more than Rough Music was. I think it's not a conscious thing. I've noticed my novels tend to swing between ones that are very autobiographical and in which one of the main characters is, like me, a gay man, and ones which are more distanced and therefore tend to be more heterosexual in focus. They kind of swing, just as they swing between town and country often as well. And this is a very country novel. It's very much, it's imbued with where I live and the countryside around Land's End. And country matters. In fact, its original title was Country Goodness, and that was rejected because I was told it sounded like a brand of margarine, which was actually part of my idea, but the marketing department didn't like that, so I gave them an even harder title to deal with, shut them up. But the novel I'm working on now is very autobiographical again, but it's sort of based on my school years, my teenage school years. So in some ways, it's thematically a sequel. It takes up where Rough Music left off, but a few years later.
And what do your ex-classmates do when you say that you're writing this, you're setting out to write this? Do they smile or do they...
No, they kind of smile, because there was a gang of us at school. We were quite formidable, about 5 or 6 of us, and who just went everywhere together, even though we weren't even in the same houses. It was a very, very kind of tough gang. And between us, we covered the waterfront, because I edited the school newspaper and was very kind of, was a music scholar, and another boy was high jump champion for Hampshire, and another boy was and one of them was really bad and got thrown out for sex and smoking, and so we covered the whole sort of gamut. But one of our group betrayed us all, and whenever we get together, we talk about this man he is now.
Does the Judas also come to the reunions, or does he just...
No, he doesn't. He doesn't know. I don't think that we all still talk and talk about him. And when I was planting cauliflowers last June, which is a wonderful, wonderfully hypnotic task. You sit on a little contraption on the back of a tractor. There are four of you, and you sit on metal seats, and you have a tray of cauliflower plants. And there's a wheel between your knees turning like a jiggity jiggity jig, and you just sit there feeding cauliflower plants in. It's completely hypnotic. And you just go up and down the field very, very slowly. And I suddenly realized I'd gone three lengths of this immensely long field, grinding my teeth with rage all over again about this boy who betrayed us all. And I thought, rather the way I did with this book, where I was thinking about writing a romantic historical novel, while doing the cauliflowers, I started hatching this plot that I was going to write a letter. Not just about him, I was angry about boys who bullied me as well. And one of the things my school does is give us all regular address books with everyone's home addresses. And I suddenly thought, I know what I'll do. I'll write a letter anonymously to the wives of all these bullies and the boy who betrayed us all. And I'll just write to them and I'll just say, do you know what he did? And then I thought, no, I won't do that. I'll write a novel about somebody who does that, and then we'll see what happens. So it's going to be a revenge novel, and I can't wait to get my teeth into it. And the friends I'm still speaking to from school are all sharpening their pens too, and are busy sending me emails saying, don't forget to put in the thing about when he did such and such. And, you know, don't forget to say that his bottom was really fat. And things like that. But of course, I'll end up being terribly sympathetic to him, and he'll never recognise himself. We'll see.
It sounds like a natural topic for a novel, but then it took all those cauliflowers before you could before it emerged.
Well, it takes a certain amount of courage too, I think, to reach the point as a writer. Well, I think it does, to reach the point where you dare to confront some of this stuff. I mean, never having been in therapy, it's taken
me. It doesn't work
this time. Well, I've seen the results, and I'd be inclined to agree. But one of the things that therapy does seem to do is make people suddenly get angry with their parents and able to voice it.
That's the whole point.
Yeah. And writing does that for me. I mean, it was only when I wrote the chapter in Rough Music where the little boy is left at boarding school by his mother and she doesn't say goodbye that I was finally able to ring my mother up. And I got in a fury writing this chapter, and I had to ring her up and say, how could you have done that to me? You know, I'd never had this conversation with her, and she cried and I cried, and it was great. You know, it was cheaper than therapy too. But I think, you know, I can't remember what the question was now. It was a wonderful question.
The novel that you're always meant to write, but then it sort of staring you in the face.
And I think you can only do it when you have enough distance on whatever the pain is that you want to winkle out, that you can walk all around it and be fair to the bad guys. Too. You need to.
Yes.
I think it sticks out a mile when someone writes a novel to get revenge on their ex-husband or something, and it's probably not such a good novel as if they gave it a bit of time and waited till they were happy and able to look down on ex-husband and say, well, you know, he was a schmuck, but. You know,
but I feel sorry for him now.
But I'm now going to write a novel about him. Yeah. So I am distancing myself from it in that I'm going to reuse. I tend to recycle things a lot in my books, and I've already gone to a lot of trouble creating an eccentric, very, very ancient boarding school in one of my earliest novels, Facing the Tank, and I've used it fleetingly again and again. And so I'm going to go back to that school, which has the great advantage in that it's a school that admits women as well as men. So I can have a female perspective on my adolescence, which I think is going to be rather fun.
So this is a school that was waiting for you to discover it, all these books.
And I didn't really get it. Brewster.
Loosely
based on my childhood
home
of Winchester. And it's when I first wrote about it was only just as a piece of background charm, really. I didn't get into great detail. So in this book, I can really get inside it and the whole kind of claustrophobic horror of it all. But it's not just going to be a horror story, because I know that one of the characters, at least, probably the girl, is going to benefit. It's going to be very much about the beauty of education, when it works well, and how it can save somebody and save them from their family and all sorts of things.
And the bullies.
And the bullies, right. and all sorts of things. Yeah.
Oh, that's very good. And how long does it take you these days? Not, you know, more than...
Well, it's a matter of waiting until there's time to start writing, in a way. I mean, the awful thing about doing well is you're required to do more and more book plugging and more book festivals and things, which I love because it gets me out of the
out of the house and off the farm, and I get to meet other writers, which I don't do much, but it is destabilizing, and you have to wait for the dust to settle before you can start writing again. But,
Are there any other questions?
I'd like to ask about how you go about researching, for example, illnesses of characters. Mm. And then secondly, in a world that you've not experienced, there are deadlines to be met. So what pressure does that put on you when you're coding a book to meet deadlines
imposed? Right, they try to impose deadlines. I mean, this book is on a two-book deal, so the school book, which I'm starting on now, is the second book in the deal, and in theory has to be delivered by, I think, next April. In practice, what I'll probably do is deliver a first draft that'll be very rough, but that's how I work. I like a lot of editing. I like to work closely with this wonderful editor I finally got. But it'll be enough to reassure them there is a book there, you know, in some form. But as to research, I love the internet. I do a lot of research on the internet. I'm very lucky in having lots of useful friends and relations. When it comes to medicine, there are now three doctors in my extended family. Well, two doctors and an epidemiologist. And between them, they gave me a lot of help with this book. I don't want to mention what the thing is, because Maureen hasn't finished the book yet. Yeah. But with my previous book, with Rough Music, where I needed a lot of stuff to do with Alzheimer's, most of that research I did really just looking around me. My parents are pretty ancient now. My dad is losing his marbles, bless him, though not officially to Alzheimer's yet. I think it's just crumble, as my doctor brother calls it. But a lot of that was also based on the experience of watching my mother having a stroke and recovering from a stroke. When I was a child, we were in a car crash together, and she lost the ability to speak and to swallow and to walk. She lost everything, really, for about 6 months, which is really disturbing when you're a child, and because you suddenly realize how much language, character is dependent on language, and if your mother loses her language and loses the ability to write, it's as if she's melting, her character is melting. And I put that together with a tragic last interview Iris Murdoch gave, in which she described, I don't know if any of you read this interview, it was rather horrific, actually. I think the journalist had got into her house without realizing just how bad the situation was, and Iris Murdoch didn't really realize she was being interviewed, and she was terribly open about what she was going through. And she described the sense of going into a dark place, and like going into a sort of tunnel and feeling the words slipping away from you. And as a writer, that was so horrific, the thought of words slipping away. And so, sorry, very waffly answer, but I think the short answer is this: I do my research from all over the place, but especially the internet and friends, the vampirism comes in. And, you know, if I suddenly remember, oh yes, I met somebody who was a tree surgeon, I can ring him up and ask him just what sort of trousers tree surgeons wear. And the answer was very interesting. They wear very interesting trousers that protect you from a chainsaw, which I didn't know.
What would you do if you wrote a historical novel? Wouldn't you get obsessed with getting
hell.
The details right?
It would be hell. Yeah. I don't think I could do it. I'm too lazy. That's why I was very bad at history at school, because I loved the stories. I loved all the Tudor stuff, because it was all the meaty stories. But I could never be bothered with getting the dates right. And in this story, there were lots of details I had to get right about the historical stuff. And a lot of the plot hinges around crucial dates and things. And, oh, it was a nightmare. And thank God for the copy editor, because she would ring me up and say, are you sure you meant 1630? Didn't mean 1628? And I actually had to spend a lot of time in Cornish archives and things. And it was interesting, but it was very hard work. And I'm quite lazy, basically. I like stuff I can do on the phone.
Well, I've changed my plot in order to avoid going to the library.
So, yeah,
but I shouldn't say that in a so close to a library. Are there any other, before we close up with another question up there? I have one more that I'll ask if you know. Right.
If anyone's too embarrassed to ask in front of an audience, you can always come up and ask me privately, but you have to buy a book.
I was going to ask you about other authors writing now. I mean, I couldn't, if I were asked to name a few other authors who write in the same area that you do in the same way, I wouldn't be able to think of any others. But who do you see as working in the same area?
Oh, it's very hard. And my brain often goes completely blank when people say that. Certainly the authors I...
instinctively read as soon as they write something new. They're all women and they're all North American, which is kind of weird. I love Anne Tyler. I think because of her breadth of sympathy. And I'm an enormous admirer of writers who can do very, very clever structural tricks and technical tricks, but it's all hidden. You think you're just reading a story, and the average reader will just think it's a book for the beach. But you, the novelist, can see just how much work goes into it. Anne Tyler does that. Yeah. She has, I don't know if you know her novel Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant.
Oh, yeah, that's
it
one of
has
my favorite
the most English. Amazing yeah. structure. It's so clever. And yet you don't realize that. You're just swept along by the story.
Canadians as well?
Margaret Atwood, I'm a big fan of. But especially her early novels. I like the books about relationships. I'm less interested in historical stuff. Yeah. Cat's Eye, I loved. I thought a wonderful novel. Carol Shields. Barbara Gowdy. I don't know if people know Barbara Gowdy here. Read her. She's amazing. She's a Canadian. She's one of these novelists who publishers despair of, because just when they've got her down as an historical novelist, she writes a book about elephants from the elephant's point of view. Yeah, how do they market that? She wrote this amazing book from the point of view of elephants, which HarperCollins had no idea how to market it, and it sank like a stone. But it was wonderful. It should have been a cult. I could have marketed it before. Anyway, but her latest one is really good. It's called The Romantic, and it's she's back on form in that it's about obsessive love, and it follows a woman who just has this sort of terrible ability to fall in love. Even when she's a child, she gets passionately attached to the woman next door. It's just a wonderful, wonderful book. It's one of those books you blush when you're reading it because you're so embarrassed on behalf of the heroine. It's amazing. Barbara Gowdy. And she also wrote some of the best short stories I've read, called We So Seldom Look on Love. And if I could write like Barbara, I'd be a very happy man.
I think we'll you don't have to write like her. Just keep on write that book. We all want to read about. We want to read the novel, and we also want you to write a little special appendix for us, telling us who he really is.
He's working as a divorce lawyer, I've just thought, which is very suitable.
Yeah. Well,
especially when his wife reads the book.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for giving us a delightful talk and reading, and thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Patrick will be signing books outside just now, and if you have any of those questions that you didn't ask, you can ask him outside. Thank you again. Good night.
Thank you.